Members, if you'll take your seats, my watch shows a little after 9, so let's get started. Welcome to the Ways and Means Committee. Rosa, will you please call the roll?
Chair Payne.
Here.
Vice Chair Zika.
Present.
Ranking Member Escalante.
Here.
Representatives Altman.
Here.
Caruso.
Here.
Casello.
Here.
Clemens.
Here.
DeSigley.
Here.
Grieco.
Here.
Hart.
Here.
Hillebrew.
Yes, ma'am.
Maggard.
You're here.
McLean.
Here.
Sabatini. Schoaf.
Here.
Silvers.
Here.
Saroy. Slosberg King.
Here.
The quorum is present, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Rosa. Members, I want to remind everyone to please silence your cell phones, electronic devices, and please turn on your mics so that you are able to record your votes when we have a roll. Members, today we have 7 bills, and we'll do a little shuffling of those. Chair Fine will be in at some point in time, but he's also in appropriations and needed there, so we'll take him as soon as he gets to the committee. But we'll start with our first bill, CS for HB 101, improvements to real property. Oops, excuse me, that's Fine's bill. Let me skip that one. Where are we? We're going to Representative Gregory, PCS for HB 1387, determination of tax exemptions. You are recognized, sir.
Thank you, Chair. CS for HB 1387, as you said, is determination for tax exemptions. This bill has to do with properties that are owned by a municipality but leased to other companies, and those properties used exclusively by the municipality or for public purposes. You can tell in the staff analysis that there has been some discrepancies around the state and the applications of Florida statutes on this law. The purpose of this bill is to clarify that the tax exemptions, once they qualify for them, extend for the life of the lease, as long as the lease, intended for that to be the case. So it is really a clarification to avoid the discrepancies and the inconsistent application of tax law in the state of Florida. That is the bill. I imagine there's going to be some questions, Chair.
Thank you, Representative Gregory. Having explained his bill, members, are there questions? Representative, Ranking Member Escalante.
Thank you so much, Chair. And you assume correctly, Representative Gregory, and I'm glad we could talk about this a little bit before you came here today. So my understanding is that one of the companies being impacted by this issue is Amazon in Lakeland at the Lakeland Airport. So I wonder if you could describe to us why what Amazon is doing should be considered a public good.
You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the question. My answer to that would be I have no idea what Amazon is doing in Lakeland. I've never had any conversations with them about this bill or the application of the bill. So I don't know how it impacts their operations there.
Follow up.
Thank you so much, Chair. Well, there's the potential for your bill to impact a lot of different companies that lease these public spaces for their own for-profit agenda. So maybe another example, if you're an airline who is running a hotel at the airport to train your employees, would that qualify as a public purpose under this bill, or would that be, chargeable for a property tax?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the question. I say yes, it's possible. It depends on whether or not they meet the statutory definition and whether it serves a public purpose. You know, just like any other fact pattern, when you present it, you got to really dig in and apply it to the law. I'd say it's possible in that scenario.
All right, follow-up, Chair.
Follow-up question.
What if you are an airline that's manufacturing private corporate jets at an airport? Would that count as public good?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Again, the question is, it depends on the facts that you're asking. You know, we could do the Socratic method all day, but you got to have all the facts. Property appraisers got to apply it to the law, apply it to the lease, and determine whether or not they're going to qualify for the exemption. But if they are part of the public good, if you want to reduce it to kind of a bright line rule, so possibly if that's contributing to the public good and the transport of passengers and good and interstate commerce and the economy or otherwise contributing to the public good at that airport, it's possible they will qualify.
All right, follow-up, Chair.
One more follow-up.
I'll shift gears a little bit. So I'm curious why we're making harder for property appraisers to revoke exemptions once they are granted.
You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair, and I appreciate that question. That really is the ultimate question. But really, I would say the question is, why are property appraisers incorrectly applying the law?
Okay. Other questions, members? Representative Hart, you're recognized.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Rep. The Revenue Estimating Conference has not reviewed the bill or come up with any numbers yet. Do we have any idea at all what the negative impact may be to our municipalities if something like this passes, based on who's already in our airports?
Thank you, Chair. That's a great question. We only know from the examples that are specified in the staff analysis of, as I said, some property appraisers that are incorrectly applying the law, we believe, and why we're clarifying it with this bill. So I don't believe it's a widespread problem. I wouldn't anticipate that it's going to have an effect on municipalities and entities across the state.
Members of Hart, you have a follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you say they're inappropriately applying the law, can you tell me, I've not been around long enough to really understand that, how are they applying the law as opposed to what we're doing now to straighten that?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Well, there's really kind of two issues here. One is, and the bill clarifies this, the definition of what constitutes a governmental, municipal, or public purpose function, right? So to provide that clarity. So maybe I'm overstating it to say they're incorrectly applying the law. Maybe there's some confusion there. So we want to clarify that to make it easier for the property appraisers around the state. And the second one is that it removes that express requirement that the property appraiser review and, you know, every year, every time they renew a lease, maybe have an opportunity to change their mind, which is what we have had happen in some instances, which is what really drove the litigation in Hillsborough County, as explained in the current situation portion of the staff analysis. So it's, you know, you have a company that qualifies or they're providing a public purpose. Nothing has changed in terms of what they're doing and their operation and their function. And then you have a property appraiser come in and say, okay, well, you qualified for the first 5 years, but you're not going to qualify this year. And so that's where I would say that's not really an appropriate function of the property appraiser. And this bill will clarify that that isn't something they should do. As long as the operation and function and purpose hasn't changed, then the tax exemption should remain in place.
Final follow-up.
Thank you. Would you consider adding to this bill not-for-profit organizations who have to apply every single year for tax exemptions for apartment buildings that we own, or then they're being used for public good, honestly, because it's affordable housing? Is there a possibility of doing something like that? Because currently, we have to apply every single year. So was that a consideration to add something like that this?
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the great question. I'm in favor of any tax exemptions and tax cuts. Generally, I think they're going to be good for the economy and good for Florida. I'm not sure if this particular bill addresses that same area of the law, since this one is, you know, more focused on ports and whether you're talking about airports or, you know, seaports, spaceports, deepwater ports. That's the section of law we're opening, so I don't think it's really part of this bill, but I'd be happy to talk to you about it later.
Members, any other questions? Ranking Member, I'll come back to you for one more.
Yes, one more. Thank you, Chair. Just looking at Section 2 of the bill, lines 104 to 124, you're making changes to the process of applying for an exemption. But I'm just curious what these changes actually amount to. So could you explain how things would be different under these changes compared to today?
Recognized.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the question. This is one of the two parts of what I said the impact of this bill would be, and this is the part that applies and says, as long as nothing has changed in the lease, they're still providing the public good, the public service, and, you know, as part of that municipality service for the public good, the property appraiser isn't to go in every year and maybe change their mind. As long as that hasn't changed, including extensions, as long as they were originally contemplated, right? So maybe you have a 5-year lease with an option for 5 years more. If nothing has changed in between there, the property appraiser, after this bill comes into effect, will not go in and change the tax-exempt status of the organization.
Members, other questions? Other questions? We have no amendments, public testimony on the bill. Michael Rubin, Florida Ports Council. He waves in support. Thank you, Mr. Rubin. Thank you for being here. Lauren Levy, Property Appraisers Association of Florida. She is waving in support. She is. All right, you are here to speak. Is that right? Okay, you can speak. Oh, I see, all right. Different forms have different notations, and sometimes they get a little confusing. So welcome, you're welcome to speak.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. My name is Lauren Levy. I'm the General Counsel for the Property Appraisers Association of Florida, which is 60 of the 67 counties. First of all, Representative Gregory, I just emailed you this morning. There were significant changes in the PCS bill that were helpful to our members. We appreciate those. We still have some concerns about the remaining language. And Mr. Chair, I would not even have gotten up and speak before we're getting a little late in the session and things tend to happen a little bit quickly. But we do have concerns with the bill. We do have concerns that it's in an effort to clarify how you go about determining whether property is exempt. It just more blurs the line and makes it more difficult. And we're certainly concerned about the kind of lock-in language that if some predecessor property appraiser made a determination, as long as nothing in the lease changed, if we have a new property appraiser or a new court decision, they would remain entitled to that exemption. But I do want to explore those issues with you. And again, I apologize for not getting with you earlier.
Thank you, Mr. Levy. Any questions for Mr. Levy? Anyone? Thank you for being here. Yes, sir. Eric Prutzman, Florida Airport Council. He is waving in support. Okay. Alan Suskey. He is waving in support. Thank you, Mr. Suskey. R.J. Myers, Henry Marine. He is waving in support. Hey, R.J. Waving support. All right, members, we are in debate. Debate on the bill. No, do you have your, are you raising your hand? Are you waving at me? Okay. I imagine I was looking for that debate from you, Representative Ranking Member. You're recognized.
Thank you so much, Chair. And thanks again, Rep. Gregory, for answering the questions. And, you know, I think one of my first concerns is the Revenue Estimating Conference. My understanding is not yet reviewed the bill for its full impact, but it does believe that there will be savings for private companies for leasing those spaces in local governments, which means there'll be a loss for local governments. And so I am curious to see what that fiscal will actually be, because I know it can be frustrating to deal with examples that we just, you know, we don't have experts in the room to answer those questions for us. But I give those examples because I do see this as a very slippery slope for some very profitable companies to define themselves as public good when I think that's questionable, even with Supreme Court precedent. I mean, at the end of the day, if, you know, Amazon companies that also, you know, lease spaces at airports like airlines or spaceports where you have, you know, of course, these large companies like Blue Origin, others, you know, they are not necessarily contributing to the public good when their company motive is profit. And, of course, we already offer a lot of incentives to many of these companies to do business in Florida. They have other types of tax benefits already. And so I have a lot of concern in rewriting statute to fit into, you know, current debates happening where Supreme Court precedent has already said that a company engaged in a for-profit business cannot be exempt from taxation simply because it leases land from a government. There's just no sense in me supporting something like this when we're talking about companies that not only have the ability to pay taxes, but at the end of the day, you know, in the case of Amazon, it's going to be potentially close to $1 million, Representative, and $1 million can pay for, you know, more than a dozen school teachers, and we really are in a delicate situation when it comes to maintaining our employment at a public level, and whether it's police, fire, or teachers, property taxes go towards their livelihoods. And so I don't think it makes sense for us to support this. And I appreciate the PCS because it does remove some of the even more harmful language in the bill. But I do think in its current form, I just can't get behind a tax break that's potentially only going to benefit very, very large companies that arguably don't need it. Thank you, Chair.
Representative Killebrew, you're recognized in the debate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to vote up on this bill today with the hopes that you'll be able to work out something with the property appraisers for the next stop. Thank you.
Representative Hart, you're recognized in debate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My concern is the fact that the Supreme Court precedent says that a company engaged in a for-profit business cannot be exempt from taxation simply because it leases land from a government. And I, too, have that concern with our taxes for our local governments. So, and I'd like to say that I really like my representative. He's been very, very kind, and he's helped me in a lot of issues, but it's hard for me to go up on this with you. But if it changes some and it's something that's palatable, I'm happy to support it in the next stop or on the floor with you.
Members of Albany, you're recognized today.
I love this bill. I think when you look at a business or a not-for-profit, or if a business is working with a governmental entity to provide services that should not be taxed, one of the most important thing is for these organizations is continuity and stability, knowing what's going to happen in the future. And if you have a lease and the activity hasn't changed, it's just logical that you allow this operation to continue and not subject them to maybe some political change or some process that could be quite disruptive and unsettling for somebody who's trying to provide a service. So I'm up on the bill.
Okay, thank you. Other members in debate? Seeing no debate, Representative Gregory recognized to close on your bill.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, members, for your support and for your questions and your debate. I'll just say a few things. First, I appreciate the property appraiser, general counsel, for their comments this morning. They hadn't reached out yet, and I understand that when a PCS is filed that they haven't had time to digest it. So I look forward to that discussion. I'm certainly open to it, and we'll see if there's any changes that need to be made. I'm not aware of any at this time, but I'll certainly talk to them about it. I think the reference to Amazon is interesting, but it's a red herring. They had nothing to do with this bill. I've never been approached by them in any way. This is about the public purpose function and really look at the underlying litigation that's referenced in the bill. You can tell by their names, Gulf Marine Repair Corporation. What are these companies doing at airports and on municipalities that serves a government purpose, right? They're providing aviation services to the public. So we're talking about the pilots that fly the planes, the ground crews that, you know, keep those planes moving and flying, the maintainers that are working on those planes. And again, we're talking about the definition of what serves a public purpose, and then whether or not, if you've already qualified for it, the law hasn't changed, whether or not you should continue to qualify for it, or if there's a change in property appraisers, whether they should be able to come in and say, you've never owed this tax before, but I read the law differently. I don't think that's the right answer. And I think, very candidly, the ability to pay more taxes is not the test for whether or not you should pay more taxes. The question on your taxes is determined only appropriately by what the law says, not whether or not you could afford to pay more taxes. And we don't have a revenue problem in the state. So with that, I ask you to vote favorably in support of this bill.
Representative Gregory, having closed on this bill, Rosa, will you please call the roll?
Chair Payne?
Yes.
Vice Chair Zika?
Yes.
Ranking Member Escomani?
No.
Representatives Altman?
Yes.
Caruso?
Yes.
Costello?
Yes.
Clemens?
Yes.
DeSigley?
Yes.
Rico?
Yes.
Hart?
No.
Killebrew?
Yes, ma'am.
Maggart?
Yes.
McLean?
Yes.
Sabatini?
Yes.
Schoaf?
Yes.
Silvers?
Yes.
Saroy?
Yes.
Slosberg King?
Yes.
Yeas, 2 nays.
Members, by your vote, show that bill reported favorably. Congratulations. We're going to move to Chair Fine, if you'll give him. Thank you. Chair Fine, you're recognized to present House Bill CS for HB 101.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for accommodating the budget presentation schedule today. HB 101 is a bill that would create new consumer protections and transparency for the PACE program, and that is the bill.
Thank you. Member, are there questions, members? Ranking member. You're recognized.
Thank you so much, Chair. Representative Fine, I don't believe your bill expands the PACE program, but could you let me know, does it expand it to any type of other options for real properties, or does it keep the current options the same?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill does not expand the PACE program.
And then follow-up, Chair?
Follow-up.
Thank you so much. It seems like we're adding more guardrails, which is a positive. I was curious, though, if we have any type of restrictions on the interest rates that can be charged, or if you'd be open to that amendment down the road.
You're recognized.
Thank you. It does not affect interest rates. I would not be open to that because I believe the market should set interest rates, and when the government gets involved and sets interest rates disproportionately, you skew the market and you end up causing all sorts of problems, including when you pay these things, most of what you're paying is the principal. If you lower the interest rates, you're going to make them more accessible, frankly, potentially to people who shouldn't have them. Not everyone should get one of these loans. This is taking on money that you owe to somebody else. And in this country, whether it's PACE or anything else, we have far too many people who take on too many debt obligations that they're going to then struggle and pay. I would not want to deceive someone by inappropriately lowering the interest rate and then having someone get into something they probably shouldn't be in the first place.
Other questions? Let me go to Representative Zika, Vice Chair Zika.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Payne, and good morning, Representative Fine.
Good morning.
I do have a question on line 458. We are changing the provision of the underlying collateral from just value to fair market value. Could you please provide some background to the committee as to the reason for the change?
You recognize.
Sure. As you all know, any of you owns a home knows that what the property appraiser sets the value of your home at may not actually be relevant to what the home is actually worth. Sometimes there are, if you've been in the home for a very long time, you may be subject to certain limitations on how much it can grow. This actually aligns the value of the home with what it's actually worth. It's a more appropriate way to do financial underwriting, as I'm sure you understand.
Follow-up.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative. In terms of the consumer protections, and granted the PACE product has a priority lien on the lien list to number one, do you think, in your opinion, if you're able to answer this to the committee, that this will impair the consumer protections in terms of extending additional credit and creating the asset where it becomes highly leveraged?
You recognize.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill does not deal with prioritization at all. The status quo remains under this bill. What this bill does is it creates new consumer protections, which effectively will make it harder for people to get one of these loans because they will have more protections to make sure that they are getting a product that is appropriate for them. The purpose here, as in most industries in Florida, we always have great providers and there's always some bad apples. That's every industry. There's no industry that's immune. And this bill is intended to target those bad apples.
Follow-up.
It's the last follow-up. Thank you, Chair Payne. Now, the max loan-to-value for the subject product, it's being incorporated in the legislation at 98% based on the fair market value versus just value. Are you open to lower the loan-to-debt provision to maybe what's considered by certain federal standards, a bit more protective for the consumers?
You're recognized.
Sure, and I'm always happy to talk. This is the first I've heard this. I'm happy to get together with you and talk about it. What I would say is this, by putting in place this cap right now, we're making sure that people don't get into a situation that they can get into today, where they end up with financings between first mortgage, second mortgage, home equity loans, whatever, that they're over 100%. Of the value of the home. This moves things in the right direction. Whether we should make the, and it's 97, by the way, whether it should be 95 or 92 or 10, I'm not saying it should be any of these. I'm happy to have that discussion, but this already moves it in the right direction.
One last follow-up. Yeah, you're right.
Thank you, Chair Payne. And the reason I'm asking is because we're basing the 98% on the fair market value versus just value. And if you have a just value product at $100,000 versus market value, let's say it's $200,000 at 98%, it truly exceeds the outstanding obligations for the homeowner. And my question to you is, would you ever consider to do a based with the change of the fair market value to potentially maybe around 70-75% loan to value so you provide the consumer some level of cushion in the event that there's a downturn in the marketplace so we don't find Florida consumers and seniors in an underwater situation like we did back in 08.
You recognize?
Sure. Like I said, I'm happy to talk about it. I would note that most people get a mortgage at 80% loan-to-value. So, you know, if you want to have the ability to do something on top of your mortgage, you're going to have to exceed that 70 to 75%. If we did that for mortgages, most people wouldn't be able to buy a home.
Right. Representative Hart, you have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Fine. I just wanted to know, my understanding, and maybe I just don't understand it when I talk to somebody from PACE, was that there's no real credit check. So all you had to do was to be the actual owner of that residence to be able to get the loan. So what if that person's already upside down and we still give them that loan? Then there's a greater possibility of them losing the house. And I'm trying to find out, there's a lien put on that homeowner's residence until that is paid off?
Representative Hart, can you identify just
one question? That's the
question, is it? Okay. So, Representative Fine, you good for that question?
I can.
Okay.
I think there are more standards than what you described right now today. This is intended to add more. And let me take a moment and go through what they are. I was trying to be respectful of your time. I don't mind. So here are some of the things that we're going to add in this bill. Number one, we're going to specify that a financing agreement may not be used to fund unnecessary ancillary work. So you get a loan and it actually doesn't do anything to actually improve the property. This is a net positive over today. The second thing we've talked about is the 97%. You can't get into a situation where you have financing over your head. Again, this is something that does not exist today. The third thing is you have to determine that the residential property owner is able to pay the assessment, that they're actually able to pay it. This is not something that is necessarily required today, and that they meet certain creditworthy standards, that they're current on their debt, that they're not having problems. These are all things that we're proposing to add to the structure today. We're going to allow the property owner to cancel the financing agreement within 3 days of signing the agreement. So you sign it, and then you sleep on it, and you go, gosh, I kind of wish I hadn't done it. You can get out 3 days after you sign it. There's that doesn't exist today. We are going to verify that any mortgage holders or loan servicers with an interest secured by the property have received a notice. So they're aware that this property that they already hold a mortgage on will now be potentially taking on one of these debt financings. We're going to ensure that the term of the financing agreement does not exceed the estimated useful life of the qualifying improvement. So if you're putting something in, I don't know, you're improving your windows to be hardened or something like that, you can't get a loan for 100 years because the windows wouldn't allow. The term of the loan can't be more than the value of what it is that you're actually doing to the place. We're going to require the acknowledgement of key terms and disclosures, both orally and in writing, before execution of the financing agreement. So people will actually have to be sure they understand what they're signing. There can't be a lot of like razzle dazzle and then, hey, sign here. There will be some of that. We're going to have licensure and background screening for PACE contractors. Again, none of these things exist today. None of the money gets distributed until you verify that the work is actually done. Because you can't just, this isn't a home equity loan. You can't just get the money and go, woo, I'm going to Las Vegas. You actually have to be doing it for a specified purpose. The money would not be distributed until then. And then imposition of marketing and communication guidelines, including some restrictions on how these are solicited and advertised. All of these things are things that protect the consumer. And what I say is the less you like the PACE program today, the more you should like this bill. Because what it does is it protects the consumer. Could there be other things? Sure. But all of these things move the needle from where we are today.
Representative Hart, you're good? Okay. Representative Caruso, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative, for the bill. I just wanted to know if the senior-junior lien position of the PACE program remains the same under the bill.
Recognize.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There's no change in the lien position of any financings under this bill.
Thank you. And follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
Thank you, sir. I like the 3-day notice or ability to cancel. Is that three weekdays, business days or weekdays?
You're recognized.
I couldn't find it.
That's a great question, and actually one that I don't remember, but I will find it in the bill. Hopefully by the time I close, if you all ask me a few more questions, and then I'll share that. I don't remember, but I'll find it.
No more questions from myself. Thank you.
Good. Vice Chair Zika, did you have one follow-up question?
Thank you, Chair Payne, and thank you, Representative Fine. Just a question. Are you open to, so I read the bill, and so, and to Representative Hart's question and to your comments around reviewing the consumer income to determine the primary source of repayment on the subject note. But while certainly the legislation as presented does require to review the income, it does not require to determine the debt to income on the eligibility if the consumer is able to pay this. So are you open to include the debt to income provisions in the subject bill?
You're recognized.
Sure. I think that's actually covered. If you've got to ensure that someone has the income to pay off the financing and you can't put the financing over a certain value of the house, I think what you're describing is implicitly included in the changes that we're making. But I would be happy to talk to you about it offline after we're done here.
Follow up.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Payne. And the debt to income I'm referring to is where you, at a federal level, there are the debt to income is based what we call the front end and the back end. And the front end is based on this proposed debt obligation. The back end is where they consider all liabilities as a consumer has. And what it does is it protects the consumer from overextending themselves when they borrow. And the way the current bill is does not have the debt to income provisions. And furthermore, it only states review, not determine. So would it be a fair assessment that you would be open to considering a debt to income provision which spelled out?
Recognize.
Thank you. I'm happy to. I don't accept the premise of the question. I think it does. So, for example, you're talking about debt unrelated to the home. You might have student loans. You might have credit card debt. Your point is there can be other sources of debt that a consumer has that are accounted for. I believe that the bill covers that right now, but I am happy to talk with you about it and see if there's ways that we can cover that right now. And by the way, to answer Rep. Caruso's question, it's 3 business days.
Good. Thank you. Other questions, members? One follow-up, ranking member.
Just one follow-up, Chair. Thanks so much. Representative Fine, I know that you outlined new consumer protections don't exist today, but I'm curious, have you worked with any consumer protection organizations, or are these just changes that the industry is okay with? I'm curious of where these changes came from. Do other states have these changes? Maybe some more of that origin story.
You're recognized, Chair Fine.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've been working on PACE legislation for a number of years. Many of these are ideas that I have worked on in the past. These are many ideas we've voted on in one committee or another in the legislature. I will tell you that the industry is not super excited by a lot of these changes. So remember, this will lead to fewer PACE financing. So if you're in the business of PACE financing, you might not like that. But there also are good actors who like the idea of they don't want consumers to get into a situation. It's not good for them. Banks don't like to give mortgages to people who can't pay them back. It's not a winner. And so this is no different than that. This is helping make sure that the right people are getting the right products and people are protected. They want folks to have a good experience. But I think in some of these things, I can't go line by line, but these are my ideas.
Okay, members, we're going to move on. You have one follow-up question.
This is the last
one. Last question.
Okay, thank you, Chair Payne. Representative Fine, line 427 of the legislation, it spells out the savings are not guaranteed that will reduce certain promises made. Subsequent to that, the homeowner has to fulfill the debt obligations. Is there any interest to include additional consumer protections where if the promises are made directly or indirectly, implied or explicit, that the consumer can get their money back if those guarantees are not fulfilled?
You're recognized.
Unfortunately, Representative Zika, you're misreading the bill. What the bill states is when the consumer has that phone call that is recorded to make sure is going on, they are told explicitly that those things are not guaranteed. So they're being told that this isn't a guarantee. Should you choose to sign it, you have to know this, because no company can promise what a utility will do or what an insurance company will do. That's an independent third party. The bill protects them from doing that, but no company can make commitments as to what another company will do. And I'd encourage you to go back and take a closer look.
Follow up.
Last question.
Just to follow up. So I did read the bill in an entirety, and it's interesting that we have a provision in the legislation that specifically states that any potential utility or insurance savings are not guaranteed. It will not reduce the annual non-ad valorem assessment or total assessment amount. Is that provision in the legislation because there have been practices that have been made by sales reps to homeowners that you'll find X amount of savings if you replace your roof or the AC unit? Are we trying to protect someone outside of the consumer? My question is there an interest to include provisions where if the promises are made outside of this legislation, is the consumer going to be protected of some kind by getting a refund back?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The purpose of this provision is to make clear that those promises can't be made. A PACE contractor or a PACE financing provider cannot promise what a utility will do. It cannot promise what an insurance company will do. It can say, we hope these things will happen, but we explicitly in this bill want customers to understand, look, you're doing this, and we think your electricity bill is going to go down. But what happens if they double rates? You know, what if you end up using more power than you used to in the past? What if insurance rates go out of control? The PACE providers can't control that, and we want to make sure that they don't imply that they can. That is the purpose for when you sign off on this loan. The paragraph you read is one of the things that consumers have to be told. They have to be told. This is the opposite of that. They're not being told you're guaranteed this. They're being told if you sign this, you have to understand these are not guaranteed. So the consumers have the information they need to make the right decision and be protected.
All right, members, we're going to move on in the interest of time for Chair Fine, who has to get back to appropriations. Are there amendments to the bill?
No, okay.
Amendments?
You're saving me from questions.
Is there public testimony? No public testimony. Members, we're in debate. Debate on the bill. Representative Caruso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you so much for bringing this bill forward, Representative. Not a fan of the PACE program. My personal experience is somebody tried to sell me an attic fan, a $200 attic fan for $4,000, and told me that the $200 a month I'd be saving on my electric bill would clearly pay for that, you know, over time, and the benefits thereafter would be insurmountable. I thought that attic fan was a great idea. I bought one for $200 and had my roofer installed for another $200, and I saved about $60 a month on my electric bill. But I love the consumer protections that you're putting in. They were desperately needed. I'm not a fan of the senior junior lien situation, knowing the benefits of your bill, I'm going to be completely up on the bill, and then we'll look to solve the other problems down the road. Thank you.
Other members in debate? Ranking member.
Thank you so much, Chair. And honestly, Representative Fine, you know, I came into this space not exactly sure how I would vote, because I agree with Representative Caruso that I do not like the PACE program. I think that it has been severely harmful for vulnerable communities, including seniors. And if you just do a quick Google search, members, you will see these stories. PACE loans have also gotten national attention. Anyone watches John Oliver, you probably saw a segment last year about this. And so it really has become a program where folks have lost their homes because of it. So coming into the space, you know, I'm happy to see the consumer protections. I think that it's still not good enough, though. And so I really appreciate the questions asked by Representative Zika, because I just feel like we have a lot more to do to actually make sure that consumers know what they're getting into. And that's why I asked about interest rates. I don't mean to, be problematic with that question, Fine, but, my understanding is for a lot of folks who are in a situation where they need a new AC, they need some sort of essential expense covered. They're in desperate situations, so any interest rate sounds, sometimes they don't process what that impact is, and that's also on us for financial literacy for Floridians. But I do worry that any type of program like this can be really harmful. So I like the protections, and I'm leaning towards voting yes, but I'm also curious whether debate there is. But I just do not like this program. And so even the fact that it exists, I think, kills me inside. But I do see the benefit of protection. So I appreciate you making those efforts, Representative Fine, and looking forward to hearing what you have to say in your debates or some of the other ideas proposed to try to make this even stronger. Thanks, Chair.
Vice Chair Zeke, recognizing debate.
Thank you, Chair Payne. And first and foremost, thank you, Representative Fine. In the Florida House, we have policy, and we have problems, and we have a process that we address those problems through policy. But obviously, I always separate that the person that's presenting the the legislation and the policies. I have utmost respect for Representative Fine. I do appreciate and I welcome some additional consumer protections when it comes to the subject product. I do have concerns. This is, to my knowledge, in my opinion, this is the only product in Florida that the government is involved in the collection of loan payments. This is the only product in the marketplace. I certainly understand this is before our time where the legislature believed that it was in the interest of the state to engage a government entity to collect loan payments for the tax collectors. But furniture companies can collect their payments through a tax collector's office or medical bills or whatever that may be. The concerns I have with the legislation is it's a material change on the availability of the equity in properties when we go from just value to market value. Furthermore, the legislation does not have guidance on how that fair market value would be assessed. Is that an income approach, cost approach, replacement approach? So we would need to really clean that up to spell it out so the consumer knows exactly how they arrive on the value of the home under the new determination. Fair market value could be interpreted so many different directions. The second piece, the legislation, I've read this many times, just in case I missed anything. The legislation only indicates that they will review the income availability to determine the primary source of repayment for the subject consumer. It does not say it will determine the debt to income and the consumer's ability to repay the loan back. Furthermore, I certainly understand the loan-to-value cap of 97%, but members, that is based on the market value versus the just value. So the availability of equity that the finance companies that will have in Florida is going to truly expand the market share, and without solid, strong consumer protections, this is going to cause issues. It's going to make 2008 mortgage-backed securities crisis just a very, really small problem relative to this. Consumers are not fully protected, and frankly, I am concerned with this unless we add the loan-to-value cap, debt-to-income, and a few other things to ensure that the consumers are fully protected. So I certainly have a tremendous amount of respect for Representative Fine. This is just the policy. I think there's more work to be done on the subject policy. So with that, I'm going to be down today on this bill. So thank you, Chair.
Other members in debate? Seeing none, Representative Fine, you're recognized to close on your bill.
Thank you. You know, this is one of these discussions where I often think we're not talking to each other the right way. The PACE program has issues that people have legitimate reasons to be concerned with. There are people who don't like the program, and I respect that, but the program exists. This isn't a debate today about whether we should have the PACE program, whether we shouldn't. There's a legitimate argument to be made that we shouldn't. But that's not the bill that's before us. There are legitimate arguments to be made about lien position. And I know that many of my friends who hold on to most of what I've got often call me and say, why are you letting these folks go before me? And that's a legitimate debate to have as well. That's not the subject of this bill. We're not changing the law. But I want folks to understand that when the legislature created this program, they did it to do so that people could do certain things that we wanted them to do, but we might not be able to have the money to do. You cannot get PACE financings to do anything you want. You can do them for a few things: energy conservation and efficiency improvements. I thought that's something that my friends, particularly on the other side in the minority, really want people to do, be more energy efficient. You can use this product for that. For renewable energy improvements, solar, you can use this for that. Wind resistance improvements, so we can be more resilient and more prepared for hurricanes, you can use it for that. But you can't use it because you want to put in, a new playroom for your children, or you want to get money to go buy a car. It's a different kind of product. And because it did things that we thought were good, we thought that we would do them. Yes, this product may have affected vulnerable communities. That is the purpose of the bill. If you go to pages 9 and 10 and 11 and 12 and 13 and 14, keep going, and 15, and it keeps going. These are all things that don't exist today to protect people. So a vote against this bill means I do not want to create more protections for the consumers than exist today. A vote for it means I'd like more consumer protections that exist today. That is literally all you're voting on. There's a famous phrase, I haven't said it yet this session. I usually say it 4 or 5 times. I will say it for the first time this session today. Voltaire, one of my favorite philosophers, often said, perfect is the enemy of the good. Do I say this is perfect? No, but it moves the ball down the field. If you think there are challenges with the PACE program, you should support the bill. If you want the status quo with the concerns that exist today, you should vote against it. With that, I close.
Chair Fine, having closed on this bill, Rosa, will you please call the roll on CS for HB 101 and announce the vote?
Chair Payne?
Yes.
Vice Chair Zika?
No.
Ranking Member Escomani?
Yes.
Representatives Altman?
Yes.
Caruso?
Yes.
Costello?
Yes.
Clemens?
Yes.
Cassigley?
Yes.
Rico?
Yes.
Hart?
Yes.
Killebrew?
Yes, ma'am.
Maggard?
Yes.
McLean?
Yes.
Sabatini? Schoaf?
Yes.
Silvers?
Yes.
Saroy?
Yes.
Slosberg King?
Yes.
17 yeas, 1 nay.
Members, by your vote, show that bill reported favorably. Congratulations, Representative Chair Fine.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. At least these questions will probably be harder than the ones I get over in the budget now. So,
thank you for being here. Yes, sir. Thank you. Okay, members, we'll move back to Representative Gregory, who has 2 more bills. So we'll take up House Bill 951, Domestic Surplus Line Insurers. You are recognized to present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, this bill will allow domestic companies that are already in the state of Florida, to enter into the surplus lines insurance market, which will hopefully increase competition. Maybe it will drive down some premiums. Honestly, they don't need to do it. We don't have to change this law for them to be able to enter the surplus lines market. All they would have to do is open another entity and Delaware or New York or Ohio or any other state, and they can already offer surplus lines here. And so you should know already that makes no sense. They can already do it unless they're already here. So this is going to change Florida law so that they can enter surplus lines insurance market and write those lines if they're domiciled in Florida. That is the bill.
Members, questions on the bill? Representative Ranking Member Escomani.
Thanks so much, Chair. I just have one question for you, Gregory. I'm just curious why these restrictions exist in Florida law in the first place. Was there some sort of consumer protection reason why that wasn't already allowed? And I know other states have already expanded it, but I'm curious as what the history is.
You're right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the question. I agree. I'm wondering the same thing. Why was this ever the law in the state or any other states? And as you point out, 21 other states already figured out and changed the law so that you could offer both in the state they're domiciled in and in other states. I haven't been able to find any legislative history that explains why it was put into place. And frankly, I'm not sure why we didn't change it 10 or 15 years ago. But now's a good time, and it would have been better previously.
Other questions? Seeing no other questions, are there amendments? No amendments. Public testimony on the bill. George Fioggio, FCCI Insurance Group. Yes. Can you pronounce your last name for me? Faiju. All right, that was close. All right, thank you, sir. Ron Haynes, Florida Justice Association. He wishes to speak. Mr. Haynes, you're recognized.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members of the committee. I'm speaking today on behalf of Florida Justice Association in opposition to this bill. Mostly because, in my opinion, surplus lines carriers are not good for the citizens of the state of Florida for 3 reasons. First, they're largely unregulated. Secondly, there is no guarantee or backup from FIGA, which is the Florida Insurance Guarantee Association. And third, there are choice of law forums that I see consistently because I represent policyholders against insurance companies on a routine basis. What I mean first by deregulation is if you are an authorized domestic insurer here in the state of Florida, that insurer has to submit their forms for approval to ORI, right? And so ORI has a chance to make sure that the citizens of Florida are protected in terms of certain coverages and, of course, in terms of specific exclusions. However, if you are a surplus lines carrier, this does not apply to you. That means that you can put anything in the policy you want, but more importantly, you can place in or take out, in terms of exclusions, whatever you would like. And there is no regulation or form or function to control that here in the state of Florida, which I believe is bad for Florida consumers. Secondly, if a domestic or authorized insurer wants to request or ask for a rate increase, they have to justify that rate increase, and that is also regulated here in the state of Florida to protect Florida consumers. That does also not apply to surplus lines. So therefore, upon renewals, the rates could go anywhere that they want, and there would be no regulation of that whatsoever. Secondly, the reason I bring up FIGA, and this is, I think, primarily important here in the state of Florida, is the legislature set up the Florida Insurance Guarantee Association. And what this does is if an insurer becomes insolvent or goes under, and there are people that are left that have claims with that insurance company, FIGA will step in and actually pay those claims. This does not apply to surplus lines insurance. FIGA only covers domestic authorized insurance companies. So the problem is if we allow a greater increase of surplus lines carriers in the state and those carriers become insolvent, who is left holding the bag at the end of the day? It's the consumer who had a valid claim, but there's no insurance company to back it up and make the payment, and therefore they can't fix their property. Lastly, I have seen with surplus lines carriers choice of law clauses inserted into their policy and have specifically had to deal with these. And what that means is they will spell out if there is a loss and there's litigation, arbitration, or appraisal, they will dictate what state laws apply to that particular action, and traditionally it has been New York, and then further say that if you want to do anything in terms of a litigation, appraisal, or arbitration, you have to do it in the state of New York. Now, that is horribly burdensome to the consumers of the state of Florida when they have a valid cause of action here in Florida, the property's here in Florida, they're here in Florida, the experts are here, everybody's here. Now we have to go to, in this particular instance, the ones I'm used to dealing with, New York, and deal with New York law that is not consumer-friendly. There are advantages to being here in Florida in terms of protecting Florida consumers. And then, of course, have the expense and burden of having to go up to a different state, specifically New York, to actually litigate, arbitrate, or appraise your loss. Those are some of the primary concerns we have. What this overall means is if we now create a category for domestic surplus lines, you are allowing a domestic authorized insurer to now get around what normally they would have to comply with. Let's create a separate entity, as the senator was kind enough to bring up, and then consider ourselves a domestic surplus lines. We don't have to regulate. We don't have to ask for rate approval. We don't have to worry about anything. And they can, in essence, that's what we're concerned about, shift the business to this unrelated section or forum. So that is the reason I'm opposed to the bill or law. I think potentially it could be amended if, for example, these surplus lines carriers have to comply with the Florida statute 627, which is the chapter that surplus lines don't have to follow. That's our insurance code. That would be one thing. If they have to, you know, comply with the regulations, I think there are ways potentially to work this out. But as the bill stands right now, those are our primary concerns that we believe it will not protect the consumers of the state of Florida. So if you have any questions, I'd be more than happy to answer
questions. Representative Clemens.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sir, so help me understand, not admitted insurers or surplus lines markets, maybe I misunderstood what you were saying. Yes, it is true that they are not regulated by the state of Florida, but my understanding of surplus lines is that those are risks that the admitted carriers are not willing to assume. So then where would you suggest residents of Florida purchase insurance if the admitted companies are not accepting those types of risk?
You recognize.
Thank you, Jordan. The way it works currently is if the agent goes out to find insurance, they have to do due diligence. And traditionally, they have to find three rejections of domestic or authorized insurance carriers before they can move to the surplus lines market. Right? That is still in place. If a Florida resident cannot get insurance from a domestic or authorized insurer, they still can't get surplus lines. Our concern is we're now expanding the number of surplus lines carriers by this bill, allowing domestic insurers to rotate over to surplus lines. that answer your question?
Follow-up.
Just one. And there was an alluding to the financial stability of a surplus lines carrier may not be as stable, according to what I heard you say. Is Lloyd's of London a surplus lines or not admitted carrier?
Yes.
Would you
make a statement that you wouldn't think that Lloyd's of London is a financially stable underwriter?
Well, if you look at a Lloyd's policy, what they do is divide it up. Technically, Lloyd's is not an insurance carrier. It's a certificate of insurance that is backed by, and it can be, I've seen in upwards of 20 or 30 different entities or individuals. They spell that out in the certificate of insurance. So yes, there is potential for instability there, but by spreading the risk, Lloyd's is a different animal because I think that's what they're trying to do is create some stability. But that's not what's going to occur here. Now we're authorizing one particular company to go out and become a surplus lines with only $15 million of policyholder surplus. As you guys know, if one hurricane rolls through the state, $15 million is going to be like a grain of sand on the beach.
Ranking member question.
I do one quick question, Chair. Thanks for being here. According to the staff analysis and just based on some research I did, it is expanding other states. So I'm curious, you know, from your perspective, why is that expansion happening? And also, is there another state that has protections that you would recommend we model after?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. I have not done the research on specifically other states' models. My concern is I think potentially this could work if we build in protections for the consumer. And I think traditionally on a national level, insurance companies are trying to get out of certain markets, certain risks, and that's why they leave it open to surplus lines. Like, for example, here in Florida, obviously everybody knows we're subject to hurricanes. California, wildfires, mudslides. So insurance companies look at the risk, right, and they determine where do we want to be, where can we make the most value for our money and not have to pay out for losses. And where they have to pay out for those losses, I think they back up and then spin everything out to the surplus lines. And you'll have surplus lines carriers that want to come in and do that. But once again, we've got premium issues. We've got guarantee issues here. So those are my concerns. Could this model work? I believe yes. But what we would like to see is protection for the Florida consumer. So in terms of some regulation, ORI allowing to do the same reviews, things of that nature, FIGA back them up. And that way we don't have a situation where a surplus lines carrier goes under and the policyholder sitting there holding the bag.
Follow up? Any other questions? Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Members, I don't have any other public testimony. Is there anyone from the audience that would like to speak? You're recognized. State your name, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. George Faizu here today representing FCCI, which is a commercial carrier based out of Sarasota. Everything you just heard was issues with the surplus lines, lines of business or the market in general. All those laws exist today for surplus lines. Any companies that are writing surplus lines are operating under those laws today. That has nothing to do with this bill. This bill is about domesticating companies here in Florida so that these companies don't go to other states, take jobs to other states, take capital to other states, just so they can write the same policies in Florida that are being written today by companies that are domesticated in other states. That's what this bill is about. This bill does nothing to change the surplus lines law. One way or the other, if they have an issue with the surplus lines law, go deal with it in a separate bill. That is not what this bill is. Just need to be very, very clear on that. And again, this is a commercial carrier, FCCI. This is to accommodate certain commercial risks that for us right now, we'd have to go to another state, set up a company just to write in Florida. If they care about being regulated in Florida, if anything, this bill would allow these companies to be domesticated in Florida under the laws of your laws that you all have passed that the Florida Office of Insurance Regulation regulates for financial insolvency for setting up a company. So all of that is just noise. If you have any questions on that, extrapolating that, please let me know.
Questions for Mr. Faizu? Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
All right, members, that concludes debate, public testimony. We're in debate. Debate on the bill. Ranking member.
Thank you so much, Chair. And thank you, Gregory. When I came in, you know, I was trying to identify if there was, you know, concerns about the bill, and I couldn't find some on my own, but hearing from one of the stakeholders, I definitely want to do some more research before I vote yes on it. But I appreciate you bringing it up. It seems like it's a trend happening around the country, but I definitely just want to make sure I do my due diligence before voting yes on it. So for today, I'm going to be a soft no, but only because I feel like I need to do some more research on it. Thanks, Chair.
Anyone else in debate? No one else in debate. Representative Gregory, you're recognized to close on your bill.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, members. And let me see if I can get you back to a soft yes, Representative Escovani. Mr. Faju's points were exactly what I was going to say. The concerns that were outlined by FJA are the concerns that they have right now about the surplus market. You know, their concerns about regulations and guarantees are not impacted by this bill whatsoever. Surplus lines exist because you can sometimes not obtain through the admitted market insurance for what you're trying to insure. You just can't get there. So you have to go to the surplus lines market. The other concern that they brought up dealing with, you know, venue and choice of law, where is the lawsuit going to be required to be filed under the terms of the contract? And then what provision, you know, what state's law are going to apply? And if you think about that, if we say you cannot be domiciled in Florida, so you have to go to, let's say, to use their example, New York, the New York company is going to choose as a choice of law, New York law and a New York venue. So by telling our companies that you cannot domicile in Florida, we are encouraging them to take those jobs, take that capital, go to another state, and force the consumers in Florida to pursue that litigation in an out-of-state venue. And that's not the right answer for Floridians. I am interested in continuing that conversation about choice of law and choice of venue. I think it is better for Floridians if litigation is necessary that it continues in the state of Florida, and I look forward to those conversations. But again, I think this is good common sense legislation for Florida, and I hope I've pulled you back over to the yes column.
Representative Gregor, having closed on this bill, Rosa, will you please call the roll on HB 951 and announce the vote?
Chair Payne?
Yes.
Vice Chair Zika?
Yes.
Ranking Member Escomani?
Yes.
Representatives Altman?
Yes.
Caruso?
Yes.
Casello? Clemens?
Yes.
DeSigley?
Yes.
Rico?
Yes.
Hart?
Yes.
Killebrew?
Yes, ma'am.
Maggard?
Hard yes.
McLean?
Yes.
Sabatini? Schoaf?
Yes.
Silvers?
Yes.
Saroy?
Yes.
Slosberg King?
Yes.
17 yeas, 0 nays.
Members, by your vote. Members, by your vote, show the bill reported favorably. Congratulations. And so we'll move to HB 1103 by Representative Gregory, North River Ranch Improvement Stewart District. You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. HB 1103 is a much easier bill. It really is just removing 11 acres from a stewardship district that we created in 2020 that were inadvertently included. That is the bill.
Members, are there questions on the bill? No questions. No amendments to the bill. Public testimony. We have Gary Hunter from North River Ranch Improvement District is waving in support. No other public testimony. Members, we're in debate. Debate on the bill. Showing no debate, Representative Gregory are recognized to close on your bill. Having waived close, Rosa, will you please call the roll on HB 1103 and announce the vote?
Chair Payne?
Yes.
Vice Chair Zika?
Yes.
Ranking Member Escomani?
Yes.
Representatives Altman?
Yes.
Caruso?
Yes.
Casello?
Yes.
Clemens?
Yes.
DeSigley?
Yes.
Grieco?
Yes.
Hart?
Yes.
Killebrew?
Yes, ma'am.
Maggard?
Yes.
McLean?
Yes.
Sabatini? Schoaf?
Yes.
Silvers?
Yes.
Saroy?
Yes.
Slosberg King?
Yes.
18 yeas, 0 nays.
Members, by your vote, show the bill is reported favorably. Congratulations. Nice triple today. Okay, members will now take up House Bill 417, Property Appraisers, by Representative Fernandez-Barquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, when our constituents appeal their property tax assessments, they appeal it to the Value Adjustment Board. If they get a favorable ruling, the property appraiser can appeal this to the circuit court. The property appraiser, to appeal it to the circuit court, must meet certain thresholds in order for the circuit court to have jurisdiction on this appeal and to hear this appeal. What my bill does is that it increases the thresholds, essentially to make it more difficult for the property appraiser to appeal these unfavorable rulings to them, to the circuit court, and thus help our constituents. And I ask for your support.
Representative Fernandez-Barkin have presented his bill. Members, are there questions on the bill? Ranking member, you have a question.
Thank you so much, Chair. Thanks, Representative Fernandez-Barkin. I'm just curious, at least my interpretation of the bill with the changes to the assessments, we're tripling the assessment threshold for the most expensive properties, but not even doubling it for the more affordable or, I guess, less expensive properties. And so my understanding is that a lot of those cases brought to the VAB tend to be more expensive properties. It's going to be hotels. It's going to be maybe more large-scale homes. So where did you get the idea to triple the assessment? Because it does seem to make it harder then for property appraisers to try to actually challenge some of these appeals.
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative, for the great question. I've spoken with shareholders on this, and I got the idea from a former property appraiser who also served in the House and who's from South Florida. And he's been guiding me through this process since he was a former property appraiser. And he suggested these numbers. I've also been in discussions with the executive director for the Miami-Dade County Property Appraiser's Office. And we have an ongoing dialogue as far as the limits go, and he's expressed his concerns regarding it. So, I mean, these numbers were just numbers that, from my understanding, were good numbers. Essentially. But listen, I'm open to increasing these even more if you think that for the lower threshold individuals, it would protect individuals who own properties that aren't valued so high. So,
follow up.
Thank you, Chair. I guess I'm just curious, do you know what percentage of VAB decisions for properties assessed at 1 million or more grant reductions of 15% or less? Like, do we have any research on that?
I don't have those specific numbers. The Revenue Estimating Commission came back that the negative impact would be about $1.3 million in total with this bill.
Other questions? Representative Hart, you're recognized.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to know if you talked to other property appraisers around the state.
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have not. I was just the Mr. Levy, who's here, just reached out to me on Tuesday, and I believe he represents, I think, 60 of the 67 property appraisers. And I've been speaking also with Mr. Bellito, who's also present in the audience, and he represents the counties that I think have a total of about 65% of the population of the state of Florida. And I've been in communication with him also.
Follow up.
Just one question, Mr. Chair. So he had no problem, the gentleman that represents the 60?
Oh,
counties.
No, they oppose it. They oppose it, but I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
That's all right. Go ahead.
Okay, thank you.
Oppose it, but I'll be meeting with him. I believe it's at 10:30 this morning.
Other questions? Ranking member.
Thank you so much, Chair. Thanks for that clarity, Rep. So I guess I'm just curious, like, why are we making it harder to appeal more expensive properties? Because that's what my interpretation of the bill does is, you know, and we've had situations in Orange County, you know, especially with all the theme parks, with, like, disputes over the values of hotels and things like that. And so I'm just curious, you know, what's the public good to do that? Because these are issues that can vary county by county based on the property assessments that individual appraisers are providing. And so I'm just curious, why are we making it harder to appeal a VAB decision when the property is more expensive?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There are certain properties from my understanding and from the individuals that I've spoken with regarding this, and I don't want to point any fingers, that there are certain what you can call big whales that are always going to be appealed to the circuit court, and then there will be other properties that will fall into a gray area, and these limits should affect just those properties that fall into this gray area and not the large whales, not the 30 to 50 or 60 cases that they do file a year that are hotly contested, that bring in very large amounts. The anticipation is that this should not so much affect that. And I don't want to reveal who told me that, but that's my understanding from a specific shareholder.
Members, other questions on the bill? Seeing no other questions, no amendments, we have public testimony. Mr. Levy, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we will be. Lauren Levy, General Counsel for the Property Appraisers Association of Florida. And we certainly will be meeting with the representative this afternoon. The last time that these thresholds went into effect in 1976, so it's well timed to modernize them. And my members don't dispute that at all. But we just believe you should modernize them by looking at the monetary part of the threshold and not the percentage part of the threshold. The Value Adjustment Board, when it was originally conceived, was called the Everyman's Tribunal. For $15, you can get some modest due process, a brief hearing, and have an independent, impartial person look at the value of your property. It has kind of evolved over that, over many years. And now, we ran some statistics, 83% of the challenges filed at the Value Adjustment Board are filed by tax reps, which earn their fee on a contingent fee basis of the tax savings. That results in the Value Adjustment Board in being maybe a little bit more contentious than you might think, and you end up with a very short hearing, a very short period of time. And what has my members' attention is this top threshold. A 15, it used to be a 5% variance, now it's going to be a 15% variance for any assessment over $1 million. I did a $340 million property this year in a 25-minute hearing that there could have been a $45 million reduction off the value of that property. And the property appraiser would have had no recourse. The taxpayer, there are no thresholds for the taxpayer. If they lose at the Value Adjustment Board or obtain a reduction less than they would like, can file suit with no reduction. There are some parameters placed on the property appraisers. These are very infrequently done. I've been doing this 30 years, maybe. I've done 10. They do a few more in Miami-Dade County. I'm sure that VAB is certainly contentious. But we would like to continue to work forward with this bill and maybe look at the monetary threshold or maybe reduce the percentage on the very top level. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Members, questions for Mr. Levy?
I have a question.
Yes, Representative Altman.
In the description of the Property Appraisal Adjustment Board process, isn't it true that most property appraisers are using special masters as well, where these properties are reviewed by real estate professionals, and they make a ruling, and then the adjustment board then can appeal that. So there's actually a multiple layer that you didn't mention in that special master layers. Isn't that true?
You recognize.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Certainly, there's special magistrates that for value petitions are real estate appraisers with expertise in the area. But there's no right to compel discovery either side, so it oftentimes is kind of a incomplete record before that person. That person may make a decision based on that record. It goes to the Value Adjustment Board that tends to accept those or reject them infrequently, but there's not a second hearing, if you would. And then both parties, if they feel strongly enough, would have the right to go to circuit court. When you're in circuit court, that's a brand new proceeding. Whatever the VAB did, doesn't matter. It's called a de novo proceeding. It's a challenge anew.
Other questions for Mr. Levy? Thank you, sir. Thank you for being here. Oh, excuse me. I'm sorry. Did you have a question? You got to be quicker than that. Representative Caruso, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would you agree, sir, that the 5% threshold for the larger appraisals, properties, valued properties, is too low to take taxpayer back to court?
You recognize.
And not too low on $1 million property, probably would be too low, but if it was a $10 million or a $20 million property, there starts, you know, it just adds up. And we see more and more of those $50 and $100 million properties going on. So if it was 5% of $1 million to some amount, I'm sorry, 15% of $1 million to, say, $2 million, and then a lower percentage as you go higher, certainly would be interested in having that discussion.
Follow up?
No, sir. Thank you.
You're good. Thank you, Mr. Levy. Appreciate it. All right, that concludes public testimony. Members, we're in debate. Debate on the bill. Representative Altman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I support this very good bill. Put yourself in the place of a property owner where you're going before a a special master that's hired as a real estate professional that vets that appeal. And then you go before a board, the Property Appraiser Adjustment Board. They're made up of county commissioners, school board members. They're the entity that's the recipient of the revenue that you pay. So a lot of times they're lean toward keeping your property assessed higher because they're benefit of the money. Sort of have a conflict there. Nevertheless, many of these bodies still, after the special master, see the benefit of the appeal and rule in their favor. But then you have this potential of the government, a very large government in a lot of cases, with substantial financial resources, then can appeal you to the circuit court. And I am 100%. It's a voter friendly, property owner friendly protection for our citizens. And I think it's a very good bill. I support it.
Thank you, member.
Thank you so much, Chair, and I appreciate the comments, Representative Altman. I think my main concern is that the vast majority of VAB appeals are brought by businesses and very wealthy homeowners, so it's not necessarily the little guy that the origination of VAB was meant to be. It really has evolved to be a litigious environment where folks who are well-resourced and have attorneys can bring these challenges forward purely because of their own assessment on their property taxes, which is their right to do so. But as we heard from Lauren Levy, I think it does need to be modernized, but I don't know if I can support the notion that we're basically really benefiting those wealthiest folks right now and the wealthiest of businesses and not everyone else. So if we can maybe balance that out to modernize it for everyone and to be thoughtful to not allowing some folks try to take advantage of the system who have the greatest of means to do so. If we can get to that point, then I can definitely be supportive of it because I do think it needs to be modernized. But the way it's written now, I just feel like it's very one-sided, and I'd like to see that changed. So thanks, Rob.
Other members in debate? Seeing none, Representative Fernandez-Barquin, you're recognized to close on your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do want to address a concern that Ranking Member Escamani brought up, and I can assure you that from what I've seen when it comes to these appeals to the Value Adjustment Board, this is a benefit that is widespread. And even the individuals of lower socioeconomic means do take advantage of this appeal. Case in point, last session, I had a bill similar to this that dealt with condo associations. And it made it easier for the condo association owners, if they got sued by the property appraiser in circuit court, to join together and essentially be a reverse class action. And in those situations, I saw cases where there were hundreds of defendants, of condo owners, of buildings that were in my district, right? And these are individuals that are fighting over a couple of $100. And in that specific bill, I made it easier for these individuals to get together so that they can hire an attorney to be able to defend this, because most attorneys are not going to take a case over $100 or a couple of $100. So this is the kind of situation, and this specific bill, I'm confident, will help people across a spectrum. And I am interested in increasing the monetary amounts. And this is a situation that I think that this is pro-taxpayer and certainly pro-constituent, and I ask all of you for your support.
Representative Fernandez-Barquin, having closed on his bill, Rosa, will you please call the roll on HB 417? Members, please turn on your mics when you vote so she can hear you.
Chair Payne?
Yes.
Vice Chair Zika?
Yes.
Ranking Member Escamani?
No.
Representatives Altman?
Yes.
Caruso?
Yes.
Casello?
Yes.
Clemens?
Yes.
DeSigley?
Yes.
Grieco?
Yes.
Hart?
No.
Hart? Oh. Hillebrew?
Yes, ma'am.
Maggart?
Yes.
McLean?
Yes.
Sabatini?
Yes.
Schoaf?
Yes.
Silvers?
Yes.
Saroy? Yes. Slosberg King?
Yes.
16 yeas, 0 nays.
Members, by your vote.
I mean, 2 nays.
2 nays. Members, by your vote, show HB 417 reported favorably. Congratulations.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
Rep. McFarland and Daly, thank you for your patience. We are going to take up Representative McFarland on Lakewood Ranch Stewardship District. You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a local bill regarding Lakewood Ranch, which is a planned community in Sarasota Manatee. Lakewood Ranch is fantastic. It's been among the top 10 performing communities in the nation for the past decade, and I'm proud to represent a portion of it. The Lakewood Ranch Stewardship District is over 24,000 acres, but it's time for them to grow. This bill would add 1,900 acres to the Stewardship District in Sarasota County, and that is the bill, Mr. Chair.
Members, questions on the bill? Seeing no questions, no amendments, we're on public testimony. Gary Hunter from Lakewood Ranch waves in support. Thank you. No other public testimony. Members, debate on the bill. Seeing no debate, you are recognized to close.
Wave close.
Having waved close, Rosa, will you please call the roll on HB 895 and announce the vote?
Chair Payne?
Yes.
Vice Chair Zika?
Yes.
Ranking Member Escamani?
Yes.
Representative Altman?
Yes.
Caruso?
Yes.
Casello?
Yes.
Clemens?
Yes.
DeSigley?
Yes.
Grieco?
Yes.
Hart?
Yes.
Killebrew?
Yes, ma'am.
Maggart?
Yes.
McLean?
Yes.
Sabatini?
Yes.
Shove?
Yes.
Silvers?
Yes.
Saroy?
Yes.
Schlossberg King?
Yes.
18 yeas, zero nays.
Members, by your vote, show the bill reported favorably. Congratulations and thank you for your patience. Members, now we're on our last bill for the day, House Bill 201, Sales Tax Holidays for Energy Star by Representative Daly. Last bill, perhaps my favorite. You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate you saving the best for last. Members, I recognize that you have an hour and a half left, which is how long we're going to need for this deeply controversial bill. It's great to be with you all today. House Bill 201 is a sales tax holiday for Energy Star and WaterSense products. This bill will offer a sales tax holiday on both of those type of products on the weekend following Earth Day, and it assists homeowners in their efforts to conserve water and electricity. In 2014, the legislature passed similar legislation. This program not only helped consumers save an estimated $1.6 million at the checkout counter, but it also saved them energy, water, and money on their bills over the long term. This bill is good for business, good for the environment, and good for the state of Florida. And that's the bill, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Members, are there questions on the bill? Representative Caruso, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative, short, quick question. The purchase has to come within this certain window in April. And does that mean it's paid for at that time or delivered and installed? Does it all have to be done within that window?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my understanding is it would need to be purchased within that window. But I'll verify that and get back with you. That's my understanding.
Thank you.
Other questions? No other questions. Do we have amendments on the bill? None. No public testimony. Is there debate? Debate on the bill. Seeing no debate, Representative Daly, you're recognized to close on your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just want to say thank you for working with me on this. I know we've had several conversations. I appreciate your time and interest in the issue. And also, members, I saved it for my close so that there wasn't rousing debate from the big UM fan, Representative Grieco, but today is the greatest day in the Capitol. It is FSU Day. Go Noles, and with that, I close. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Rosa, will you please call the roll on HB 201 and announce the vote?
Chair Payne.
Yes.
Vice Chair Zika?
Yes.
Ranking Member Escamani?
Yes.
Representatives Altman?
Yes.
Caruso?
Yes.
Casello?
Yes.
Clemens?
Yes.
DeSigley?
Yes.
Grieco?
Yes. Go Canes.
Hart?
Yes.
Killebrew?
Yes, ma'am.
Maggart?
Yes.
McLean?
Yes.
Sabatini?
Yes.
Shove?
Yes.
Silvers? Yes. Saroy?
Yes.
Schlossberg King?
Yes.
18 yeas, zero nays.
Members, by your vote, show that bill reported favorably. Congratulations, Representative Daly. Just to members, a couple of comments. Our next meeting is scheduled for Thursday, February 17th at 11:30 a.m. I've had several members ask questions lately about the tax package, and certainly has been busy in the office trying to deal with tax package issues. So we expect to have a committee bill. We're not exactly sure when that will be, but most likely in the next week or so. I wanted to give our staff director, Vince Aldridge, just a few minutes to talk about the process and what we anticipate this year with the tax package and the timing of the tax package, because it can vary a little bit from year to year. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would expect that the committee would consider a committee bill soon. It's week five already, so next week or week seven, likely. I don't think you've made a decision on that yet, Mr. Chairman. After that happens, in the past, there have been times where the tax package bill has been referred to committee, normally the Appropriations Committee. There have been other times, like last year, where it did not receive an additional committee reference and went straight to the floor. So that has yet to be determined how that will play out. After that, of course, when negotiations are had between the presiding officers on budget allocations, it normally includes some agreement as to how much money is going to be allocated for tax cut purposes, and then there would be a negotiation between the House and the Senate on what the final product would look like. So that's a basic overview of what we can expect over the next few weeks.
Good. Thank you, Mr. Aldridge. Any questions for Mr. Aldridge? Good. Members, that concludes our meeting for the day. Without objection, Representative Casello moves we rise, and we're adjourned.